I'm John Strum, and this is Real Talk MS. It's July 19th, and we have a lot to talk about. Thanks to newer medications and earlier treatment, people with MS are living longer than ever before. And with that longevity comes aging, and for many people, the question of what to expect as they grow older. Joining me to talk about managing MS and age-related changes is Dr. John Corboy. Dr. Corboy is a professor of neurology at the University of Colorado School of Medicine and the director of the Rocky Mountain Multiple Sclerosis Center at the University of Colorado. Dr. Corboy is also the principal investigator in a recently completed clinical trial that focused on the effects of stopping MS disease-modifying medications in older people living with MS. We'll get into the results of that clinical trial, along with some of the other things that you may want to consider as you age with MS. But before we get to my conversation with Dr. Corboy, there are a few other things that you should know about. This past May, in episode 246 of Real Talk MS, our guest was Stephanie Stern. Stephanie is the National MS Society's Vice President of Advocacy, and in that episode, we talked about Stephanie's recent experience testifying about MS prescription drug prices before the Senate Finance Committee. By the way, if you'd like to catch our conversation with Stephanie, you can point your browser at realtalkms.com/246, and we'll include that link in today's show notes. But the reason I'm bringing this up today is just last week, the Senate Finance Committee forwarded revised prescription drug provisions to be included in a scaled-back reconciliation package that will hopefully be put forward for a vote in Congress. The revised proposals include implementing a $2,000 out-of-pocket cap on Medicare Part D drug costs and implementing a smoothing mechanism so that people on Medicare can spread their costs over the course of the entire year. The proposals also include limiting drug price increases by implementing rebates if prescription drug prices rise faster than inflation, and directing Medicare to negotiate better prices for select prescription drugs for Medicare beneficiaries. If you listen to my conversation with Stephanie, I think you'll hear that these are some of the specific things that MS activists were asking for. Following their release, the National MS Society issued a statement voicing strong support for these latest legislative proposals. If you'd like to review the MS Society's statement, you'll find a link in today's show notes. Now, this reconciliation package is by no means a sure thing, but it's a step in the right direction, and we'll keep you updated on its progress. As someone who believes in both the powerful and empowering effects of advocacy, I'll also take this opportunity to invite you to join us and become an MS activist. If you'd like to be a difference maker when it comes to how public policy affects people living with MS, you can learn more by visiting nationalmssociety.org/advocacy, and you'll find that link in today's show notes. While we're looking back at some of our past guests, just a year ago, we talked with Professor Helen Tremlett about the prodromal phase of MS. Professor Tremlett is a professor and Canada Research Chair in Neuroepidemiology and Multiple Sclerosis at the University of British Columbia. And the word prodrome comes from the Greek word prodromos, which means running before. In medicine, a prodrome is a sign or symptom or a set of signs or symptoms that indicate the onset of a disease before diagnostically specific symptoms develop. The MS prodrome would present before demyelination occurs. Just a few weeks before my conversation with Professor Tremlett, the MS Society of Canada partnered with the National MS Society in convening a virtual workshop focused on the multiple sclerosis prodrome. The workshop was titled Prodromal Multiple Sclerosis, Gaps, Opportunities, and Priorities. It was co-chaired by Professor Tremlett and another past guest on the podcast, Dr. Ruth Ann Mary. And the workshop participants included some of the leading MS research scientists in the world. I was fortunate enough to be invited to participate in this workshop, and the reason we're talking about it today is that the workshop led to a paper being written, and that paper was published just a few days ago. The paper is entitled, From the Prodromal Stage of Multiple Sclerosis to Disease Prevention. And it speaks to how understanding and identifying the MS prodrome may lead to proactively preventing MS symptoms before they ever develop. If you'd like to be among the first to review this paper, you'll find a link in today's show notes. When we think about not just managing MS, but actually improving your quality of life, it's almost natural to assume that improvement may come as a result of the latest pharmaceutical intervention. And certainly, getting on the right disease-modifying MS medication is a foundational step in delaying MS progression. But there's also a substantial amount of evidence that supports the value and importance, once you're on a DMT, of making smart lifestyle choices. And the newly published results of a study in Belgium adds further evidence that you don't have to wait for another pill, injection, or infusion. This study shows that being smart about things like smoking, diet, and exercise can make a real measurable difference not only in your quality of life, but in actual disease progression. Now, in this study, the researchers looked at 351 people living with MS. They evaluated lifestyle factors and health metrics, including cognitive reserve, physical activity, smoking status, alcohol use, dietary habits, body mass index, blood pressure, and cholesterol ratio. The researchers also measured neurofilament light chain levels in the blood to determine ongoing brain damage among those study participants who had non-active MS and were on a high-efficacy disease-modifying medication. The research team then performed a complex statistical analysis, something called multiple regression analysis, to explore the relationship between these lifestyle factors, multiple sclerosis severity scores, and neurofilament light chain levels. They found that study participants with higher cognitive reserve and higher levels of physical activity had lower multiple sclerosis severity scores. They also found that study participants who were overweight or obese and had high blood pressure had higher multiple sclerosis severity scores. And the research team concluded that their study showed an association between what you might think of as a brain-healthy lifestyle and disability progression in MS. They further concluded that a cognitive and physically active lifestyle, along with a normal body weight and blood pressure, may help to prevent future MS-related disability. We certainly can't yet control who gets MS or why someone gets MS, but a growing body of research underscores how much a person can do to impact how much MS is going to get in the way of living their very best life by choosing not to smoke, choosing regular exercise or physical activity, and choosing to eat a healthy diet. And there's no prescription required for any of that. Now, if you'd like to review the details of this study, you'll find a link in today's show notes. It's no secret to anyone listening to this podcast that the cost of MS disease-modifying medications is astronomically high. But what will surprise you is how many of these medications, several costing over $100,000 a year, are actually wasted. When you're on most any prescription medication, it's not unusual to get that robocall or text from your pharmacy telling you that your 30-day or 3-month prescription refill is ready to be picked up. It's convenient to have the pharmacy keep track of when you're nearing the time for a prescription refill, but what if somewhere within that previous 3-month window, you and your neurologist have decided to switch to a different disease-modifying medication? What happens if, for whatever reason, you've skipped a couple of doses over the past couple of months, or you decided to take an unofficial drug holiday while you were on vacation. Now, these scenarios may not be recommended, but they take place every day. So what happens to that no longer needed 3-month or 6-month supply of a disease-modifying medication that's sitting in a closet, in a cabinet under the sink, or that's already been tossed out with the trash? Dr. Darren Okuda, a professor of neurology and director of neuroinnovation and the Multiple Sclerosis and Neuroimmunology Imaging Program at the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center at Dallas, decided to try to answer that question. So Dr. Okuda and his colleagues launched a study at their clinic. The study ran for exactly 1 year, from January 1st, 2018 through December 31st, 2018. During that time, new and existing patients were invited to dispose of their unwanted or unneeded disease-modifying therapies at the clinic. Now, those patients who brought DMTs to the clinic for disposal also completed a questionnaire that covered their reasons for making treatment transitions. A total of 422 patients participated in this project. 79.9% of them were covered by commercial insurance, and 19% were covered by Medicare. The questionnaires revealed that 60% of these patients switched DMTs for non-medical reasons. For example, a desire to switch from an injectable to an oral medication. And over the course of this 1 year study, the commercial value of the DMTs that were brought to the clinic for disposal was, are you ready? $5,152,632.02. Now keep in mind, this was a single site study involving just 422 people. It's frightening to consider what that number might look like in a broader context. Dr. Okuda and his team pointed out that the likelihood of DMT discontinuation will continue to increase over time as the MS population ages and as new treatments continue to hit the market. The team concluded that reducing the cost of healthcare in the United States might be as simple as only paying for treatments that are actually used by patients. Well, I hope this unsettling news serves as a springboard for further study. With so many people unable to access these same medications because of their high cost, surely there's a better solution here. If you'd like to review the details of this study, you'll find a link in today's show notes. Dr. Okuda and his team pointed out that one of the reasons that some people stop their disease-modifying therapy is age. My guest, Dr. John Corboy, is the principal investigator in a recently completed clinical trial that focused on the effects of stopping MS disease-modifying therapies in older people living with MS. In a moment, we'll meet my guest, Dr. John Corboy. Thanks to newer medications and earlier treatment, people with MS are living longer than ever before. And with that longevity comes aging. And for many people, the question of what to expect as they grow older. Joining me to talk about managing MS and age-related changes is Dr. John Corboy. Dr. Corboy is a professor of neurology at the University of Colorado School of Medicine and the director of the Rocky Mountain Multiple Sclerosis Center at the University of Colorado. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Corboy.
Thanks, John. I appreciate you having me on.
Most people living with MS are diagnosed between the ages of 20 and 40, but the average age of someone living with MS is actually between 55 and 65, and 15% of the people living with MS are over the age of 65. What sorts of differences do you see between younger people with MS and older people with MS?
Well, John, thanks for that question. It's a very important one. As you know, there's a large number of individuals over the age of 55 who have MS because people are living longer with MS now and living longer in general. And the biggest difference from the MS point of view, if you're diagnosed when you're, say, 30 or 35, is that as you age, relapses become much less common. changes on your MRI scan become less common. But a small but significant minority of MS patients may go into a progressive phase where they have slow worsening, primarily independent of relapses. And the so-called secondary progressive phase is where many people can accrue significant disability. So dealing with that disability is important. Another important difference that may occur over time is that they'll have advancement of other problems, other conditions, comorbidities that can have an impact on their life as well and be confused with MS and can perhaps make their MS more of a challenge. So, for example, if you have some trouble walking with MS as you age and you also then have low back problems or maybe hip problems that may also contribute to walking problems, then that can be ganging up on you, if you will. And that is an important change that can occur that is not typically seen in our younger patients. And a big change that can occur over time is that the medicines that are presently used, the disease-modifying therapies that we've all come to know and love and sometimes hate, have also perhaps a change in their ability to have an impact, as well as having perhaps a higher risk for some of them as you age. So a number of different things change as you age with MS, and some of them are good, less relapses, less new scan changes, but some of them are actually more challenging as well.
Given that disease activity seems to slow as people age, many people wonder if they can eventually go off their disease-modifying medications. You recently completed a study called DISCO-MS to learn more about the impact of stopping MS medications in older people who are living with MS. And before we get to what you learned, can you tell me how this clinical trial was set up and who participated in the trial?
Thanks, John. Yes, we did just complete the DISCO-MS study, and it's been reported at the Consortium of MS Centers and the papers in progress. And we started thinking about this a number of years ago. One of our colleagues in Minnesota, Gary Birnbaum, actually deserves credit for first thinking about this roughly 10 to 12 years ago, if not longer. But our patients have been telling us for a while now, because the drugs have been available for almost 30 years, and many patients have used the drug for a long period of time and have had either long-term stability or, in spite of taking the medicines, have had slow worsening that's progressed over time. So our patients have just said, well, does this make sense for me to continue to use this medication? And then on the basis of that, we wrote a grant, which is funded by the National MS Society, as well as the Patient-Centered Outcomes Research Institute, PCORI, the primary funder. And we wrote a grant and started recruiting people in 2017 and then finished the study in August of 2021. And aside from our patients telling us that they were wondering about this question, we also know from a variety of different types of studies that the medicines are just more effective in younger people, and it's difficult to identify obvious benefits or even not obvious benefits in people as they age. And this is partly the case because many of the studies that were done did not include people over the age of 55. Some of them did go up to age 60 to 65 in the progressive MS studies. But many of those studies actually did not show benefit. So the combination of that and also looking at some studies that have just from observational studies, not randomized controlled trials, but observational studies and like databases, they've also shown that some people can successfully go off medications. And the highest risk for having new disease activity should you go off of medication appears to be the same thing that's associated with best response. That is, those who are younger, those who have more recent disease activity on a scan or with a relapse, they not only respond the best to the medications, but they are more likely to have recurrence of disease activity if they go off medication. So conversely, if you've been doing well, that raises the question, is it reasonable to have a trial off medication? So we did the study at 20 centers throughout the United States, 19 with recruitment around the country, both coast and middle of the country, as well as, of course, here in Colorado. And then also the data center at the University of Alabama, Birmingham. And over the course of 2017 to 2020, we recruited people and ultimately recruited, after screening over 5,000 people, many of whom just simply didn't fulfill the criteria, we ended up with 259 patients for our randomized, controlled, rater-blinded discontinuation trial. That's a mouthful.
Well, can you share what you learned in this trial?
So the people who actually went into the study, it was 50-50 randomization. We ended up with 128 who continued their medication, 131 who did not. That is, were randomized to go off drug. The average age of people in the study was about 63, about 22 years since onset of symptoms on average, and 14 years from last relapse on average. Everyone had to be at least 5 years from having their last relapse and at least 3 years from having a scan change. And they had to be on the same medication for at least the last 2 years, but some medication for at least the last 5 years. And so about 63 average age, 90% were white, 80 plus percent were women. So even a higher rate of women than even in our typical MS studies. And about 70 plus percent were still using injectable medications like Copaxone or one of the interferons. So that was the basic population. And there was no difference between the group that stayed on medication compared to those who went off medication in terms of their age, sexual distribution, and as well as which medications they were using. So they were well balanced. And our primary outcome measure was whether or not you had a new relapse or a new scan change. And then secondarily, we looked at individuals having a change on their examination, a disability progression, and then also looked at quality of life, some cognitive studies, symptoms questionnaires, and then also adverse events. And this was a somewhat unique study. Most of the time, we think of a new drug coming on the market as compared to a placebo or maybe to an older drug. And we try to prove that the new drug is better. In this case, it was the exact opposite. We were taking a medicine away, and we were trying to prove that the drug discontinuation was not inferior to continuation. And that's a different statistical question. And there were three possible outcomes. The drug could be shown to be truly inferior when you went off of it. The drug discontinuation could be shown to be not inferior. And we have a so what we call a margin of inferiority or non-inferiority, whereas we'd accept a little bit of difference, but outside of a certain range, we would not accept. We would say that that's not okay. That's inferior. A third possibility is that we would be sort of in between. It looks like the drug, when you look at the error bars or the confidence intervals, if you were to repeat the study many times over, how often would the study fail or not fail, then that would be an indeterminate outcome where you couldn't show that it was inferior, but you also couldn't show that it was not inferior. And so what did we find in this population of people when we followed them for an average of 22 months? What we found that was clinical activity was very uncommon. New relapses, only one in the continue group, three in the discontinue group. Progression of disability was about 11% in the group that was continuing drug, 12% in the discontinuation. Neither one of those was different between them, and there was non-inferiority if you just looked at relapses alone. But our primary outcome measure was relapse or a scan change, either one. And there was a slight increased risk of scan changes. Of the 22 people that had the primary outcome measure, six in the continue group, one relapse, and five with new scan changes, and 16 in the discontinue group, three who had relapses and 13 who had just scan changes. Most of the differences were just scan changes. And most of the differences were just 1 to 2 new dots on the brain scan over that 22-month period of time. Actually, as it turns out, 15 of the 22 events, either scan or relapses, were just 1 or 2 new dots on the brain scan. And the significance of that is not clear. But what that did, though, that small increase gave us an indeterminate outcome when we actually did the statistical analysis. Not clearly inferior and not clearly not inferior. But everything else that we measured, symptoms, no difference. Cognitive test, the symbol digit modality test, no difference. Quality of life, no difference. Adverse events, the number of people with adverse events and serious adverse events was no different. So the big answer is that we mostly saw no difference between those who continued and discontinued drug, but there seemed to be a very small amount of increased level of new scan activity in those who discontinued. And we also noticed that when we looked at those who might have active lesions, those who have, after the injection of contrast material, you can see the leakage of the dye and see so-called enhancement on the scans. Now, not everybody got contrast enhancing studies in our trial. Only about 60% did that all the way through. And six people had enhancing lesions out of the roughly 180 or 190 who had the scans. All of those, however, had discontinued drug. So that's another marker that there's a small amount of radiologic activity that's ongoing, even if people are not having a relapse and even if people are not having a change in disability. And in fact, that's what we showed. There was no really relationship between new scan activity or new relapse activity and having a change on your examination. They seem to be independent events. And interestingly, we would have expected that perhaps the people who were in the study who had progressive MS, which was about 17% of the population, 83% had relapsing MS. We would have expected most people who had progressive MS already, when we measured that during the study, well, they would be the ones who maybe progressed during the study. Turns out that was really not much the case. It was no different. 83% of the people who had progression actually were relapsing MS patients, and that's the number of people with relapsing MS who were in the study. So that means either they were misclassified as having progressive, as not having progressive MS, they're misclassified as having relapsing MS, or they may have converted to progressive MS during the study. I think the latter is less likely. They probably just had very difficult to determine slow progression. And many studies have shown that the doctors are not very good when people are first having this very slow progression. We're not as good as we'd like to be at actually identifying that. So, that was also an interesting sidebar that although progression was uncommon, it occurred mostly in the people that were the most common people in the study, those with relapsing MS.
MS causes variable symptoms, and so does aging. Can you talk about some of the common mental and physical changes associated with aging that can be similar to or even overlap with symptoms of MS, and maybe comment on how people living with MS can monitor what's going on so that they can tell the difference?
Sure. There are many examples of that, John. Maybe three big ones are cognitive changes that can occur over time, the simple ones that we all have, but then also we know that some people unfortunately develop a degenerative disease of their nervous system, such as Alzheimer's. A lot of those symptoms can be the same kinds of symptoms that we see in MS. Walking difficulties. Walking difficulties are very common in MS, but also as people age, their balance is not as good as it used to be. Their strength is not as good as it may be when they were younger. And also, they may have developed some problems, such as hip problems, knee problems, back problems, or even other degenerative disorders of their nervous system that might mimic the changes that we see in MS. And then also, depression and anxiety are very common in MS. They're very common in society. They are absolutely a major issue as people age and have to be addressed. And there can be a link to those things and an intersection with a lot of those things. And then other factors that play a role in disrupting those things, both for MS and for non-MS patients, such as common symptoms like sleep disturbance, constipation, sexual dysfunction. All of those things are more common as people age and also are common in people with MS and can certainly make MS worse. When I see a patient with fatigue, for example, I could easily say, oh, that's just your MS. We'll just deal with that. Actually, not true. Oftentimes, there are other causes for MS, fatigue that are not MS. And the biggest one is sleep disruption, because as people age, they get obstructive sleep apnea. They might have periodic leg movements to sleep or other things that disrupt their sleep. They may have a dog that sleeps in the bed with them and disrupts their sleep. So there are a number of things that can be very common as symptoms, fatigue being perhaps the most common, that are absolutely overlapping between aging and between other conditions that people get as they age and MS.
as we've just been discussing, as people with MS grow older, it's not unusual for some of them to develop these other health conditions. These are called comorbidities. Can you share some strategies for reducing the chance of developing a comorbid condition, or at least better managing comorbidities if you're already living with MS?
Yeah, the most important thing is just pay attention to what's going on with your body. And to also not make the assumption that everything is due to MS. Both patients and doctors fall into that habit sometime because, of course, MS can cause a ton of different things. But there are many things that are just simply different and can be related to aging. And we certainly wouldn't want to miss something important like vascular disease, a heart attack, cancer, or some other thing that is more common as we age. And some of these can be difficult because they can mimic MS. People can get a neuropathy with diabetes. They can get more numbness in their feet. That could be due to diabetes or it could be due to MS. So number one, pay attention to your body. Number two, have a good team of doctors, a primary care doctor, as well as perhaps any other specialists to go along with your neurologist. And just don't make the assumption that it's related to everything is related to MS. In addition, do all the things that we would like to do for good general health. So stay as close to your ideal body weight as possible. Exercise a great deal. Take vitamin D. Don't smoke. Eat a good diet. Get good sleep. All of those things matter a great deal. And then also with your primary care doctor, get your colonoscopy, get your mammogram, make sure your hemoglobin A1C doesn't suggest you have diabetes. Get your thyroid checked. You can have a lot of thyroid changes as people age, and that can disrupt your sleep. It can also just cause fatigue and other things throughout the day, even can cause a neuropathy. And those things can all make your MS worse. So good general care and staying in touch with your primary care doc.
You just mentioned getting a good team of doctors. As someone with MS ages, should they be thinking about adding new members to their healthcare team?
It depends on what's going on with them individually, of course. And there's now, this didn't exist really when I was in training, but now there's a whole field of medicine called geriatric medicine. And they deal with a lot of the problems that are unique to people as they age. So sometimes people will find that the best primary care doctor to have is a geriatrician because they are focused specifically on people as they age. For women, I think it's important to make sure that they have a good gynecologist or maybe a family doctor who makes sure that they get their pap smears and mammograms and other things like that on a routine basis. I think it really focuses mostly on those things. But as people age, they may need a good physical therapist. They may not see him all the time, but maybe they see him every couple of years for a tune-up. They may want to have a good doctor that's helping them with other things that are common, like, say, constipation or other things like that, that are difficult to manage and that sometimes I need help from the GI tract doctors. So it'll depend upon what kind of symptoms they have more than anything, I think.
Well, Dr. John Corboy, thank you for all that you do to improve the lives of people living with MS. And thanks for talking with me today.
Thank you, John. I appreciate the opportunity and you have a great weekend.
That's going to wrap up this episode of Real Talk MS. Real Talk MS is powered by the National MS Society. And you can share this episode of the podcast by letting your friends or family members know that all they have to do is point their web browser at realtalkms.com/255. You'll find that link in today's show notes, so you can easily copy and paste it right into an email or a text. And if you have a minute, I hope you'll visit the Apple App Store or the Google Play Store and download the free Real Talk MS app for your iOS or Android smartphone or tablet. It's the best way for us to stay connected. The app will automatically download the latest episode of Real Talk MS. You'll be able to access any of our past episodes. You'll be able to save your favorite episodes. And it's a great way for me to share bonus content with you. The app is free, so I hope you'll download it today. I'm John Strum. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and make healthy choices.